I wonder whether those at the back could come up closer, because I want you to do something. It's very easy, isn't it? You know, you come along to a talk and you think you're just going to sit there, you know, sit there kind of comfortably, not going to get involved. What I want you to do, I want you just to turn around to the people behind you. I want you to sit, well, if you're on the second row, you'll be responding to the people in front of you. And just say to that person your name, and that person say to you what their name is, right? Yep. So you do that now. Okay. Not your life story, just your name. So last week I talked about breaking out of your comfort zone. And the greatest risk, I think, is playing it safe. For all we know, we've got this kind of one life, haven't we? We've got this kind of one opportunity, this human opportunity. And it's said that to optimize our potential, to become who we could be, we need to go out of our comfort zone. In fact, people say you need to go out of your comfort zone several times a day. Out of the zone of habit and routine and safety. And if you don't do that, there is a penalty. And that is that the comfort zone becomes more narrow. It doesn't stay the same, it becomes narrower and narrower. So going out of your comfort zone pushes the barriers back. You become bigger. You start getting a sense of who you are. You get a sense of who you are by moving into the unknown, not by staying in the safe, not by staying in the known. And we are human beings. We are the creators of this world for good and bad, because we've done that. We've done that as a species. We've kind of pushed the barriers kind of back. And it's also, I talked about my experience at the Manchester Buddha Centre last week, and I talked about Sanghanath and his work at Karana, didn't I? And those who were here. And going beyond the comfort zone can sound a bit kind of, I don't know, a bit too challenging. But what happens too is you enter into the realm of adventure. You get bigger. You become more confident. You enjoy and you develop the initiative in your life, and that is so important. So we've had we had a year of spiritual friendship. That was last year, wasn't it? And this year is the year of spiritual community. And so why are we having these years? We're having them for a reason, I think, aren't we? We're having them because we want in Cambridge, not just in Cambridge, but in Cambridge, to develop a centre that embodies that more, is imbued with that more. So our centre teaches the Dharma. We have open doors. We teach the Dharma to whoever is interested in the Dharma. But we've got to be more than that. We've got to kind of create an environment with one another that welcomes people in. It's not a night school. It's a community. So I think the whole series of events this year, last year, is to kind of remind us of that. So I'm going to be talking again about Sangha. And I'm talking about Sangha not because I kind of want to. I'd much prefer to be in my community in some ways tonight. Maybe watch a film or something. And hurry through my community meal kind of to get here. And you've done the same. I know. I appreciate that. But Sangha is really important. For me, it's been it's been the boon of my life. Spiritual friendship, contact in the Sangha has been a real boon in my life. Tonight, I'm going to talk about communication. And I'm going to talk about it in a more kind of impressionistic kind of way. I'm going to be talking about certain factors of communication, but I hope to leave just an impression with you. A couple of weeks ago, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, maybe a little bit more, we had the elections, didn't we? We had the European elections and we had the local elections. And I don't know what it was about the place I live in, but we were a magnet for people knocking on our door trying to tell us about their policies. And sometimes I hear politicians on the television. And I long for them just to answer the question. They're asked a question, aren't they, by, an interviewer. And they hedge and they're evasive and they spin. And I long for them to say, yes, you are right, we made a mistake. You know, what would that be like? Well, I can tell you what it would be like. Probably they'd be getting into a lot of trouble with their party. And the opposition would make a field day of it, wouldn't they? And the press, it would be all over the press. So while they talk about, politicians talk about the importance of communication, they talk about the importance of communicating their message to us, it didn't strike me as very much communication goes on. I'll just tell you, getting away from my script again, I'm always doing this, but we had the Conservative candidate come to the house where I live, the community where I live, and he was talking about immigration to me, and I said, immigration is fantastic, isn't it? You know, we enrich our culture, we enrich our economy by people coming from abroad. And he looked at me, and he didn't know what to say. You know, he was not expecting me to say that. He was completely off script, and he changed the subject. I can't remember what we went on to. So I'm going to talk about communication, and one of the questions I want to ask you tonight. It said that when you're giving talks, you shouldn't ask your audience a question because they disappear into it. But this isn't a talk. This is just an evening with Aunt Priya, just sharing some thoughts with you in this armchair. Quite harmless. So the question for you is, who do you know who you would say is a good communicator? I don't mean a smooth and slick communicator. I mean just a good communicator. And have you considered what it is that makes them a good communicator? Or you just take that for, you haven't even thought about it. Because I think it's worth kind of observing them. We learn, don't we? We learn very often by copying. We don't use the word copying, we use the word emulate. But we do, we copy people. And then in time we need to make it our own. Bhante Sangharakshita said we're like this with the precepts. Sometimes we don't know, we don't really know why it may be important to be vegetarian, but the people at the centre, the order members, mitras are vegetarian, so we become a vegetarian. But at a certain point you need to understand why you have done that. Actually, the precepts are quite a good example of this, because the precepts are based on an observation, if you like, of those beings who are free or freer of greed, hate and delusion. For them, it's not a practice, it's a spontaneous kind of activity. And he said if you want to experience a state of mind, which for them it's a natural expression, you behave in that way. You behave with empathy. And the basis of ethics is empathy. Sometimes I know in the Buddhist tradition we talk about empathy. We talk about ethics being the basis for meditation, meditation being the basis for wisdom. But it makes ethics sound as if it's kind of instrumental, something to be left behind at a certain point. And it's never left behind. It's left behind as a kind of practice. It becomes a spontaneous activity. And it's rooted, ethics is rooted in empathy. It's rooted in the sense of you being alive, and life is a mystery in a way. You being alive to the mystery of life, and you being aware of that in the other person. With this little pulse of life, transient, beautiful, and we're aware of that in other people. And one of my spiritual practices, this could be a huge rationalisation, but one of my spiritual practices is sitting in Nero's. Sometimes I'm lucky enough that a friend has given me a fully stamped up card, so I get a free coffee. But I sit in Nero's and I gaze out the window and I look at people. I look at people, and I was doing this early on in the week. I was supposed to be writing this, but I forgot my pen, so I couldn't make any alterations. So I just sat and I looked out the window. I love doing that. I love looking at people. They're so kind of interesting, and they're in all sorts of states of mind, you know. And I kind of imagine what is happening with them. So if you've got that perspective of empathy, if your ethics are rooted in empathy, in that identification of the life within you and the life within the other, you cannot exploit people. You cannot harm people. You want to cherish life. I can think of someone I know who I think is a good communicator. And I'm going to try and convey some of the reasons why I think that. I don't think the reason so much as kind of sense of feeling for that. He's a man with a lot of responsibility, and that can make him busy. I mean, so often we Buddhists are, aren't they? We're quite kind of busy. But when we meet, I feel like we've got all the time in the world. I feel he's fully present. I don't feel as if within half an hour or an hour there's going to be a knock at the door and somebody waiting, the next person waiting to come in. I don't feel that. I look up to this particular person, but when we communicate as equals. That's how it feels. He's not giving me the benefit of his advice. I feel we meet as equals. We talk as equals. And I feel like I can say that anything on my mind, I can share anything on my mind. And if I want to talk through something, he listens. Not just hearing the word, but he really listens. And I can feel it. I can feel something kind of drawn out of me. I came across this quote from Carl Rogers. I don't know whether you know who Carl Rogers is. He's a kind of founder of person-centered counselling. And he says, and I need my glasses for this. He says, when someone really hears you without passing judgment on you, without trying to take responsibility for you, without trying to mould you, it feels damn good. You need an American accent for that. When I have been listened to, and when I have been heard, I am able to re-perceive my world in a new way and go on. It is astonishing how elements that seemed insoluble become soluble when someone listens. How confusion that seemed turn into relatively clear, flowing streams when one is heard. It feels damn good when somebody listens to you without judgment. Not trying to take responsibility for you. Not trying to mould you. And this is how I feel with this particular friend of mine. Whatever his opinion on what we might be talking about, he will try, while we're talking, to just understand my particular position, my side. Clarify that he's done that by asking deft questions. He's not trying to solve a problem, solve a puzzle. He's not trying to fix me. I think sometimes men are not so good at this. Sometimes it's a little bit like you put the car bonnet up, you know, in your personal life, and they're in there trying to fix you. He also respects me enough to know that I can kind of fix myself. So I've quoted Carl Rogers, but I don't think of my friend as a therapist or a counsellor. We're communicating. That's what's happening. Sometimes I want to talk something through with him. Sometimes we're just talking about anything and everything. Sometimes I've been talking with someone, and maybe they've been talking about themselves for quite a long time. And then they ask me how I am. I don't know whether you've done this. How I am. And sometimes I find that hard to answer. And I thought the problem is with me. I thought it's because I'm a bit reticent sometimes about talking about myself. And I think I am a bit reticent sometimes. But I think I've discovered that although the person is asking me, they're not really interested. They're not really interested in me. It's good form at some point in the conversation to ask how the other person is. So I think we need to be genuinely interested in the other person too. It has to be mutual. It has to be reciprocated for communication to happen. It's good to observe the qualities of your friend. We can certainly also enhance our communication skills, but this needs to be done with honest self-awareness, I think. I know of people who've used learned skills to mask their inability to communicate. And when that has happened, you feel like a technique is being used on you. You don't feel like you're being communicated with. One of the signs, I think, that this isn't happening is I remember somebody doing NVC with me, and I felt like they were not doing NVC with me. I had no trace of it. I had no sense of it. Other people to take NVC, if you're really interested in NVC and you're listening to this recording, I'm not having a go at NVC, but sometimes with NVC language, you can feel something is being done to you. So we need to be honest with ourselves and others. I've been reading Ted Hughes' Tales from Ovid. Anybody read that? Yeah, it's great actually. It's the Greek myths, and the power of these myths is that they have something to say to each generation, something new to say to each generation. We interpret them differently to the way the ancients did. They have a power to be interpreted, reinterpreted again and again. So this is Narcissus. This the myth of Narcissus. So Narcissus was a beautiful youth. But he was proud, and he spurned the company and attention of others. Young men and young women fell in love with him, but he rejected them. One of the people that he rejected calls out to the gods and says, "May Narcissus know how this feels." And apparently the gods' nemesis heard him. So one day, out hunting, he came to a pool of water, clear, pure, cool pool of water. And he bent to drink from the pool, and he saw the most beautiful face looking back at him. And he was enchanted, as we are sometimes, by a beautiful face, are we not? When he bent his face towards the youth moved towards him. He became besotted by what he saw. He couldn't move away from what he saw in the pool. When he moved to touch his lips to the lips of the beloved, as he touched his lips, it all disappeared. When he moved to embrace the figure, it vanished into the water. When he declared his love, he could see the other declaring their love too, although he couldn't hear that. So for the first time in his life, he fell completely and overpoweringly in love. And he could see that love reflected in the eyes of the beloved. Tears sprang into his eyes because he couldn't reach his beloved, and he could see the pain reflected in the other's face. He couldn't move away from his love, and he couldn't consummate his love either. And so he died, realizing that he had, in the end, realizing that he had fallen in love with his own reflection. I'm not going to mention poor Echo in all this. That's another story. And so poor Narcissus is remembered for falling in love with himself. And he feels that pain that so many others felt when he rejected them. He fell in love with the surface reflection of things, and he perished in doing so. And this is said to be the age of Narcissus, isn't it? This modern social media age. Modern social media has been likened to the pool in which Narcissus saw himself without realizing it. And it seems tragic that Narcissus could have had friends, real friends, not virtual friends, but he spurned them. I've given a talk on Narcissus. Do you remember this? On Padmasambhava Day a few years ago, I gave a talk on the demon of Narcissus, and you can listen to that on the centre's website. So I'm not going to say any more, except to say that communication, I think real communication, is an antidote to the plight of Narcissus. The narcissist is unable really to love others. He must always be at the centre. They want an entourage without any responsibility. When you communicate with others, you get involved with them. You have a response to them. What comes over in the myth is how very painful it is to be obsessed with yourself and blind to others. We are social beings, and we are at a very deep level connected with one another. I don't have to tell you this. It is painful, isn't it, to be obsessed with yourself? And we get obsessed with ourselves from time to time. Shantideva, the great Indian sage, the 8th century, says, "All the unhappiness in the world comes from wanting oneself alone to be happy. All the happiness in the world comes from wanting others to be happy." So communication is something that happens between at least two people. And while it might start as something on the surface, it has the possibility of being something that has echoes of the deep. And communication does not mean having to talk a lot either. You might be relieved to hear. This is from one of the ancient Buddhist texts. It says, "Listen to the sound of water. Listen to the water running through chasms and rocks. It is the minor streams that make a loud noise. The great waters flow silently." So the small streams make much noise, and the deep rivers flow silently. The Buddha is called Shakyamuni, and one of the ways of rendering that is the silent sage. Not silent as in soundless, but silent as in deep. The great waters flow silently. Communication finally resolves into silence. So the talk, the title of this this evening is called Echoes of the Deep. And it puts me in mind of the singing of whales. These massive beings living in the depths of the ocean. I had it in mind that I might bring along a recording of one of the whales singing, but I decided not to do that. I won't be doing an impression either. So their song carries for hundreds of miles. They go and they wah, 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 that kind of thing. Anyway, I looked this up in Google, the great oracle, Google. And it says that whale songs can carry for 3,000-4,000 miles through the sea. That seems absolutely incredible. So they believe that whale songs in the coast of America could carry right through to the opposite coast. Except ships, the volume of shipping has interrupted, broken the singing of the whales. That seems, I don't know, very kind of tragic in a way. I don't imagine the Buddha ever saw the ocean. He talked about the ocean. And he talked about the ocean as a deep, mysterious ocean. And he liked to compare the qualities of the ocean with the qualities of the Dharma. And you probably know that he said once that just as the ocean, the great ocean, has one taste, the taste of salt, so the Dharma has one taste, the taste of freedom. But he also said that the great ocean is full of fabulous beings, like the whales. And the Dharma also is the abode of fabulous beings. Those who realize the Dharma, the noble Sangha. And it is these beings and less fabulous beings, like some of us. Some of you are quite fab. that communicate the Dharma, that sing out the Dharma. Buddhism really is communication. Buddhism begins with communication. You remember the episode of Kandanya. The Buddha communicates the Dharma and Kandanya awakens to that. The Buddha is not only the enlightened one, he is the great communicator. And he's communicating from the enlightened mind across the great chasm to the unenlightened mind. And he does this in all sorts of ways. He does this through teaching the Dharma. He does this through symbols and mantra. It's an echo of the deep. The voice of the Buddha is the echo of the deep breaching the void. He's like one of those great whales, and his song covers not just great distances, but great time scales. And it's still fresh. It comes to us fresh, new. The Pali Canon is one of the oldest of the Buddhist collections of texts. And it's largely made up of conversations, dialogues, between the Buddha and someone else. He's not just giving a talk, he's actually talking to someone. He's not doing it in the abstract. He's actually answering a question. Somebody has a spiritual need, somebody has a question for him, and he's answering them. What they actually need right now. And when you read the text, you're listening to a conversation. And what you might find there might speak to you too. And the Buddha says quite a lot about communication in those texts, those early texts. He gives advice how to deal with grudges and resentments. It's quite encouraging in a way that right back in the Buddha's time, when the Buddha was around, there were still resentments. There was still the Sangha falling out with one another. There's an episode, isn't there, where the two groups of monks fall out. Because one of them has left a water pot in the toilet. That's a bit like using the last sheet on the toilet roll and not replacing it. That would be what it would be for us. And the other group of monks thinks this is terrible, you know, and they end up abusing one another, using verbal daggers and so forth. So I find that quite encouraging. That they were like that too. It's easy to think of the golden age, isn't it? When the Buddha was around, the disciples were all kind of wonderful. They weren't. They were a whole mixture. Just as we are. He also gives detailed advice about how to cultivate loving kindness. The Metta Bhavana comes from those texts. Compassion and sympathetic joy. One of the training methods he gives to his disciples are the 10 precepts. And it is these same precepts that are taken by order members when they're ordained into the order. And they promise, they make a vow that they will keep those precepts for the rest of their life. It's noteworthy, I think, that 4 of those precepts are to do with speech. 3 are to do with body, 3 are to do with mind, 4 to do with speech, because this gets us into trouble. This runs away with itself. They say, this says something about the importance of speech and how much of an area it is for transformation. So the 4 speech precepts come in 2 forms. They come in a negative form and they come in a positive form. In the negative form, we train in terms of giving up and skillful speech, and in the positive form, we train in cultivating skillful speech. So it's not just a case of not doing, because that would mean in the end just keeping your mouth shut. So it's not just that. It's about how to speak positively. So the speech precepts are abstaining from untruthfulness and cultivating truthfulness. Abstaining from harsh speech and cultivating harmonious speech. Abstaining from useless speech and cultivating helpful speech. And finally, abstaining from slanderous speech and cultivating harmonious speech. So on one side you've got not lying, not being harsh, not being superficial, not slandering and creating division. And on the positive cultivation side, you've got speaking the truth, speaking kindly and establishing rapport, speaking meaningfully and promoting unity and harmony. And Bunty has talked about the importance of speaking the truth. And he begins by emphasizing factual speech. But the facts are always spoken in a context. I was talking about this with Samudra Ghoshi the other day. He was giving a talk, I think, on Monday night about the speech, a truthful speech, I think. And we got on to talking about what he called, I don't know whether this is a Samudra Ghoshi-ism, but he talked about remote communication. Maybe it is used in other forums, but remote communication is that communication when we're not in the company of someone else. Social media, emails, Twitter, Facebook and all that. And I think with remote communication, we need to be especially careful that we establish rapport and harmony and empathy. Because we're missing the other cues, aren't we? The cues that can spark off empathy. The cues that are there when we're face-to-face with people. And I think if you are face-to-face with people, you wouldn't say some of the things you say by email or Twitter. I was reading the news tonight, and some young man has been sent to prison for sending horrible kind of Twitter remarks on the death of someone. He didn't know the person. He just sent these horrible remarks. And it seems a shame that the law has to be invoked with that, because it just seems, I don't know, common human humanity that you don't communicate particular things anyway. The Buddha said that he only spoke when the time was right and it was going to benefit the other person. If it was not a benefit and the time wasn't right, he didn't say it. So I want to concentrate on truthful communication, but I'm going to talk about slander comes into this too. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to talk to you about a play by Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller wrote a play called The Crucible. And he wrote the play in the 1950s. He's an American author. And it was in the time of McCarthy. Senator McCarthy was at the forefront of a kind of witch hunt, coming out of kind of a paranoia in America about, I suppose, the Soviet Union and communists. There were communists everywhere in America. That's what they thought. And Arthur Miller was accused of being a communist, and he was forced, or they were trying to force him, to name others. That's what they do. You name other people. You name other people. And it was enough that you were accused to be blacklisted in those days. Anyway, Arthur Miller wrote this play, and it's set in the 1690s in Salem. It's about the Salem witch trials in Massachusetts. And I went to see the play in Manchester. In Manchester at the Corn Exchange, big Victorian building, I suppose. And in the Corn Exchange is this really modern, at least it was modern, it's probably a bit dated now, new theatre. It's like a space. capsule. And it's theatre in the round, so you all sit around the stage. And I went to see the play there, and it was electrifying. It was absolutely electrifying. And you felt as if you were part of the proceedings. The story starts with a young girl lying in a bed, and she is unresponsive. She's the daughter of the minister, a Christian minister. Salem is a very tight-knit community in America. Very, very kind of a rigid form of kind of Christianity. Very, very narrow. And there are all sorts of things under the surface. All sorts of conflicts under the surface of the community. And Christianity, the virtues of Christianity, plastered over the top. Anyway, the minister is worried that his daughter won't respond. She's just lying in bed. And he discovered his daughter and some young girls in the woods the night before doing some kind of ritual, some kind of singing and dancing around the fire. And it was being led by his black slave. Abigail Williams is the minister's niece, I think. Abigail is one of the main characters of the play. She's very, very headstrong. She's very kind of willful and very kind of vindictive young lady. Now, where am I going to... without telling you the whole of the play, where to go with this? It's suspected that the young girl, witchcraft, has played a part in this. So the minister has sent for Reverend Hale, another minister, who expertise is the dark arts. And Hale comes, and before you know where you are, they're accusing the black slave, Tituba, that's her name. And she thinks she is going to be killed. She's going to be executed. So she admits that they were doing black magic rites. They were calling up the devil. To save herself, she says this. The girls admit they were doing that, and they start naming other people. And before you know it, all sorts of innocent people are being named as taking part in these satanic rites. There's a real fear in the 1690s of witchcraft. Satan kind of overthrowing things. And when you think of it, there they are. They're at this outpost in America. The dark forests are all around. A certain kind of hysteria and a repression, sexual kind of repression there, breaking through. One of the other main characters is a man called John Proctor. He's married to a woman called Elizabeth. And Abigail Williams worked for the Proctors for a while, and she had a fling with John Proctor. And she is determined to get rid of his wife and become his new wife. So she accuses Elizabeth Proctor of being a witch. And she's arrested, and John Proctor can do nothing to save her. He's confessed to his wife that he did commit adultery with Abigail, and Abigail is thrown out of the house. This is before the accusation. So all sorts of scores are being settled within the town. All sorts of conflicts that have been rumbling away are settled now by accusations of witchcraft. So in the end, dozens of people are arrested, are sent to prison. The deputy governor comes to judge those who have been accused. And it's enough to be accused. The only way of surviving is to admit your guilt. So truth becomes a lie, and lies become the truth. Yeah. So you admit you're innocent, but you have to admit that you're guilty in order to save yourself. If you stick with the truth, then you will hang. So this is all kind of escalating. It's getting worse and worse. The girls are kind of believing almost that they've been bewitched. And they've gone too far to come back. It's a bit like a lie, isn't it? Once you tell a lie, you have to tell more lies and more lies to cover the earlier lies. To go back then and to say, I was lying, really gets you into trouble. So John Proctor is determined to save his wife. And he admits to the court that he has committed adultery with Abigail Williams. Now, in that close-knit Christian community, to admit that you are a lecher, to admit that you have committed adultery is one of the worst things you can do. One of the very worst things you can kind of do. But he has to take that, he has to do that in order to save his wife. So he is saying to the judge that Abigail has come up with these charges out of vindictiveness because his wife threw her out of the house because she was an adulteress. And that is the basis for all these difficulties. His wife, Elizabeth Proctor, is known for always telling the truth. She never lies. The village know this, the town know this. So the judge says, okay, you say that you told your wife that you had committed adultery. And that is the reason why she threw Abigail out. And he says, yes. He says, okay, well, bring her in. Bring her in from the cells. So his wife is brought into the courthouse, and the judge says to John Proctor and to Abigail, turn your back to her. Do not look at her. So the wife is brought in, and the judge says to Elizabeth Proctor, you threw Abigail out. You sacked Abigail, who was working for you. Elizabeth Proctor says, yes, I did. And the judge says, well, why did you do that? And she said, well, she wasn't satisfactory. And he pushes her. And then she is asked, she keeps wanting to look at her husband. And the judge says, no, look at me only. Do not look at your husband. And he says to her, did you know that your husband had committed adultery with Abigail Williams? And this, don't forget, is a woman who does not lie. And in the theatre, when I watched it, the atmosphere was electric at this point. And what is she going to answer? You know, so many lives depend on it. What is she going to answer? And she lies. She says, because she thinks this will save her husband, she says, no, he did not commit adultery. And then the husband shouts out, but she's lying to save me. And the judge says, you said your wife never lies. So she's taken back to the cell. John Proctor is taken to prison, and he's going to hang. A little bit more of the play. So the minister, Reverend Hale, the expert in the black arts, has started to change his mind. He believes John Proctor is telling the truth, but the judge won't have it. So the only way that John Proctor will be saved is if he admits to practicing witchcraft. So Reverend Hale persuades Elizabeth Proctor to talk to her husband and see whether he will sign a confession. That's the only way that he's going to live. She goes to see him. And in the end, he says, yes, I will sign the confession. I love life most, you know. So he says, I will sign a confession. And the judge and Reverend Hale say, thank goodness, you know, thank goodness he's doing that. Sign the confession and we will nail it on the church door. And that will show the villagers. That will be kind of proved to the villagers that there has been witchcraft here. You know, it will be further proof. But at this point, John Proctor will not sign. He says, I've made the confession, that should be enough. And they force him and they force him, and the judge will not accept you unless his name is on it. And there's a real moving part of the play where he says, you have taken my soul, leave me my name. And they refuse, so he tears up his confession. In a moment of kind of integrity, he realizes that he would rather die than give up his name, give up who he is. And his wife, Elizabeth, she will not take that goodness from him. So this is the act of a truthful man. She will not take that goodness from him. And he is hung. So that is a true story, the Salem witch trials, a true story. Many, many people, hundreds of people, thousands of people in Europe and America were murdered for witchcraft in those years. It wasn't as bad under McCarthy. You weren't executed for being a communist, but your life was ruined. You were blacklisted. You wouldn't be able to kind of work as a musician or a playwright or an actor. When lies become the truth and truth becomes lies, the basis, the very basis for human civilization disappears. Some brave souls will still speak the truth, but they very often perish for doing so. So without the possibility of honest communication, civilization is not possible. And the Sangha must be different. The Sangha, Bhante says, is a free association of individuals. And with that goes a responsibility to maintain that free association. It must be based on ethics. It must allow one another to say what we think and what we feel. And we need to create harmony and empathy for this really to be possible. To create Sangha, we need communication. Sangha is communication. It comes into being when there is real communication. It is the Buddha's communication with us, right from that first moment, that gives us the basis for Sangha, that sets up Sangha. And it is our communication with one another that make us a Sangha. And our communication to the world that is part of our responsibility as a Sangha. So I'm going to finish by telling you another story. This time... I must just tell you, when we got to Manchester, there was a break in the production, you know, while we had coffee and ice creams and that, and there was a woman sitting behind me. I didn't know her, but she was talking to her friend, and she expressed something that I'd been feeling through the play, and she said, at one point, I wanted to say, he is innocent! You know, and she was not in the cast, she was in the audience. I felt that too. We felt, you know, this can't go on. But there was a kind of momentum to it. There was a horrible kind of momentum to it. It would go on, and these people would perish. So this is a story. I thought I'd better tell you a story from the Buddhist text, because last week Dharadasa said I pepper my talks with stories from the Pali canon, and I didn't mention it last week. So this is about a young disciple of the Buddha, and this young disciple wants to go to this country where the people are very aggressive. Very unfriendly and very aggressive. Yeah. I don't know where this country is. And he will be the only Buddhist there. He will be the only follower of the Buddhist there. The Buddha's not sure about this. And he says to him, but what if those people abuse you? And the young man says, well, I shall be glad if they don't beat me. And the Buddha says, okay. But what if they beat you? And he says, well, I shall be glad they don't threaten me with knives. And the Buddha says, okay. But what if they do threaten you with knives? And he said, well, I should be glad that they don't attack me with the knives and stab me to death. And the Buddha says, okay, but what if they do? Attack you with knives and stab you to death. And he said, well, we all have to die sometime. It's put in a slightly more formal way than that. So what does the Buddha make of this? He's quite taken with this young man. He sees it, he's not going into it with his eyes shut. I mean, he's green, isn't he? He's a bit naive. Oh, to have this spirit again, you know, in our movement. Anyway, I'm going to go to Hull. I'm going to go to Grimsby. You know, people said that. But what is a... So he takes the young man in. He's optimistic. He's inspired. And he gives him his blessing. And he goes off. And it's interesting that this young man is not a monk. He is a lay Buddhist. And he goes off to this dangerous country with these aggressive and unfriendly people. And nothing is heard of him again. So moving on. Some years later, the Buddha is in the locality of this country. And he goes and visits the guy still alive, Hataka. He goes to visit this young man, still young. And the young man is overjoyed to see his teacher. And he says, they arrange, the Buddha will stay in the jungle. He never stays under in a town or a city. And the young man, Hataka, will meet the Buddha in the jungle, in the forest, later. And later that evening, Hataka goes to meet the Buddha. But he's not alone. He's with hundreds of other people. Hundreds of them, men and women, and they're all carrying flowers, and they're all carrying kind of lights and gifts for the Buddha, and they all feel that this is their teacher. They've never met him before, but Hataka has communicated something of the Buddha to them. He's communicated something of the Dharma to them. He's created a sangha. That's what Hataka has done. He's created a sangha, and all these people, hundreds of them, feel that the Buddha is their teacher. They feel they're part of the Buddhist Sangha. And the Buddha is really pleased with this, as you might imagine. And, you know, he says, Hataka, how have you managed to do this? How have you accomplished this? And he said, well, it's you, Lord. You taught me the four factors for creating a Sangha. The Sangrahavastus, the four factors for creating a Sangha, unifying the Sangha. It was you. You taught me it. And I have actually put it into effect. So you actually put the Buddha's teaching into effect. Imagine that. thanks, that was a joke. and I'm going to talk. I'm going to say something about those four factors. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what Bhante says, and then I'm going to make a few comments on it. He says the Bodhisattva's aim is not just to lead people to enlightenment individually, but to enlist their cooperation in building the Buddha land for the benefit of all. Which is what we're doing here, isn't it? A Buddha land is a context, an environment, a world even created by Buddha, where the conditions for practicing the Dharma are really, really excellent, really, really supportive. And the Sangha, our Sangha, is a Buddha field under the conditions of the ordinary world. The Sangha is a context which makes practicing the Dharma much more possible. It's so much more difficult, even perhaps impossible to do on your own. So we are creating a Buddha field in Tri Ratna. So these are the four primary conditions you need to create a Sangha or spiritual community. The first is generosity, but it's a particular kind of just generosity. He says here it is a means of establishing positive contact between people, of creating spiritual friendship, of helping to form a spiritual community. We usually tend to give people something because they need it, but Dharma in this context is not quite like that. You give people things because you like them. You give people things because you like them, because you want to be spiritual friends with them. Not in a calculating way. The whole process is completely natural, completely spontaneous. By giving someone a present, you give expression to your special awareness of them, your positive feeling towards them, your special concern for them. Giving is in fact a form of communication. We could say that as a general principle, the spiritual community is characterized by the constant exchange of presents among its members. The exchange of presents strengthens the spiritual community. It is a natural expression of the life of the spiritual community. These gifts are not given in return for anything. You just naturally feel like giving to one another, and you express that feeling by giving gifts. So that's what Bhante says about the first thing, about dana. Giving in this context of building sangha. And I was really taken by that, by what he said. And I felt kind of a bit sobered. I felt I've got a lot to do in that area. The sangha is characterized by the continuous exchange of presents between its members. I think we've got quite a lot to do, haven't we, in that area. As Buddhists, we may not celebrate Christmas. I like to give presents at Christmas, actually. I think you could give presents at Christmas, but I think you need other opportunities when you can do that. I remember in Manchester, we tried to make Sangha Day a bit like Christmas, and each member of the Sangha, for a while, didn't really kind of take off very much. Every member of the Sangha brought something to give to someone else on Sangha Day for a couple of years. But I think we've got so much more to do in that area. Fantastic, isn't it? You don't give it in return for anything. You don't give it to get anything. You just want to give. We just give because we want to, because we like. We even love this person, these people. Our giving is an expression of our feeling of connection, and our connection grows and deepens because of this constant exchange. We will give material things, but really what we're giving ourselves to each other. I think if we did that more, it would be fantastic, wouldn't it? It would be wonderful. I'm going to start doing it. I've convinced myself I'm going to start doing it. We're under the delusion, the Buddha says, that we have got a fixed self, and that fixed self owns things and possesses things. In truth, we are dynamic. We're a fluid, dynamic identity. That's why we can change. We can only change because of that. That fluid, open self doesn't own itself, never mind possessions. Sometimes it's not like we own things. Things own us. We're owned by our things. Money too, which is such an important symbol for us, a symbol of enrichment. So sometimes giving money away, you feel impoverished. You feel you've lost something when you give money away. But money has to flow. Money is dynamic. It doesn't sit in the bank, does it? All the time, it's flowing into something because it is kind of energy. Otherwise, it becomes stagnant. We're only temporary stewards of our belongings and possessions, and we need to ensure that we're not possessed by them, or there will be trouble. You'll be a kind of slave to your possessions. You know that kind of thing where you read a novel? I mean, I love reading novels. You read a novel, and you keep it. There it is on your bookshelf. What's it doing there? If it was so good, you know, share it with someone. If it wasn't, get rid of it. Bring it to the centre, something like that, I don't know. I believe that Dharmacity back there has been getting rid of things, moving things on, simplifying his life. And I heard a few details about that. I was quite taken with that. If you don't use something, I think over a period of time you get rid of it, don't you? Fantastic. So we're temporary stewards. When we die, it is a cliche to say we cannot take it with us. But we can't. A cliche or not, you cannot take it with you. Rumi, the great Sufi poet and sage, says that the only thing you can take through death's door is love. That is the only thing you can take. That's the only thing you are permitted to take into the next world, as it were, love. And you can only do that if you have loved. And if you're going to take anything, let it be that. Let it be love. So live simply, the Buddha exhorts, whether you are a householder or single, whatever your lifestyle. Live more simply. And to do this, you can change your relationship with your things. So share your things. It makes sense environmentally to do this too. But it has a direct effect spiritually, I think. Sharing. This is Buddhist Action Week, I think, isn't it? Or Buddhist Action Month. So I think there were some posters on the board about Buddhist Action Month. Try that out. Try other things out. Do something. From this talk tonight, take something away that you are going to do. I'd like to see us at the Buddhist Centre living more communally. I don't mean all living in communities. That's not what I mean. Although I love living in my community. I love living in community. I mean sharing things with each other and helping each other out with quite practical things. Let me use a very mundane example. We have got in our shed one, at least one, maybe two lawnmowers. We've only got a titchy bit of lawn. Why do we all need lawnmowers? So in the Sangha, you know, there are lots of little gardens, I imagine, maybe bigger gardens. We've all got a lawnmower. We don't all need lawnmowers. Let us share things. Let us call on one another. I'd love that. I'd love there to be a kind of Buddhist economy where we could ask for help with things. We do things kind of together. Someone needs a particular item. You've got one. Maybe you hardly use it. Share it. In Manchester, when I was chairman, we had skills auctions. It was to raise money, but actually it was a great Sangha building exercise. People would offer things. People would say, well, I will come round and I will cook you a curry. And one of the items on the list as well was you could spend an afternoon with the men or women's Mitra Kamuna. You took them out for cream tea and you could get to know them. And somebody bought me. I was quite chuffed, actually. There was a bit of competition. Who was going to buy me? I thought when I put my name on the list, you know, nobody would bid. But they did bid. And I got to know someone I'd not known before. So why don't we have something like that? More spontaneous picnics. Again, Ivan was organising picnics. Maybe not on Wednesday nights. So come on. You know, if we want to be a Sangha, let us get to know one another better. That leads me to the next factor. The next factor is Priyavardhita. This is the second factor in building your Sangha, building a Sangha. It means loving speech, kindly speech. Bhante says here, this is another familiar quality that the Buddhist seeks to develop. The Bodhisattva establishes contact with people by speaking to them in an emotionally positive and kindly manner. A Bodhisattva is not afraid of giving expression to affection for others, of letting other people know he likes them. He's not even afraid of telling them to their face that he likes them, in case there is any doubt about it. Some people find it difficult to believe that anyone likes them. Here, Priyavardhita is being practiced by the Bodhisattva as a means of helping create the spiritual community. The Bodhisattva's loving speech is an expression of his transcendental wisdom. The love to which the Bodhisattva gives verbal expression is not just love in the ordinary sense. It is not ordinary human affection. Here love is an expression of spiritual insight, of the Bodhisattva's delighted awareness of people's spiritual potential. Under dana, we are giving and sharing our stuff, which in effect means that we are giving and sharing ourselves. We are doing this because we like the other person. Here, with loving speech, we are telling them directly that we like them, and we are telling other people that too. So this can go against the grain. If you're a reserved European, you notice I don't just say English, but if you're a reserved European, that might go against the grain a bit. And it is not because us Northern Europeans don't feel things. We do feel things. Men feel things. But they're understated, aren't they? Well, maybe we need to overstate things a bit. Maybe in Buddhist Action Month, we could overstate things a bit. At least for a while, we could try it out. We could go beyond our comfort zone. There is nothing, I think, that brings together people more than each of them knowing that the other person likes them. If you know someone really likes you, it connects you. One of the speech precepts that order members take at ordination and say they will keep during their entire lives is kindly speech. But the one I want to touch on here is the one where we will avoid slander and we will foster harmony. This is the other side of kind of priyavartita. This is the other side of loving speech. There is no limit to the harm done where we hear someone criticizing someone else over here and we go and tell the person criticized what they have said. Why do we do that? Why do we feel a need to do that? Unless we want to stir up trouble. If you're a Buddhist, if you're at all interested in creating Sangha, we must never do this. We must do the opposite. And the opposite is that when you hear something good over here, somebody says to me, Thay Dasa, fantastic, I just love what he's doing at the centre. They don't tell him, but they tell me. I've got a duty. I can take that duty joyfully and tell Taradasa what has been said. One, it makes a bridge between him and that person. And it's great to hear that what you're doing is having a positive effect. One of the big things for me when I came along to the movement years and years ago was at my second meeting in the Catholic chaplaincy all those years ago. At my second meeting, one of the team remembered my name. I was really chuffed by that. I wasn't just an anonymous person. They weren't just being generally nice, you know. They remembered my name. I remember so clearly those mikvahs and order members who encouraged me and took an interest in me when I was new. I will never forget that. I will never forget that, their kindness to me. But let's admit it, it's hard sometimes to know what to say to someone when you meet them for the first time. People are surprised that I find that hard. I'm quite a shy person underneath. It can feel awkward, can't it? You don't know what to say to them. There they are standing at the posters, looking at the posters, desperately looking at the posters, as I did when I was new. You are on the team. Hello. Just be yourself. You don't need to be scintillating. You don't need to be fascinating. Just be friendly. Bhante said somewhere that you can't always be happy, but you can always be friendly. And you can do this when you're feeling awful. What is more, if you act in that way and you feel awful, I think you will start to feel better. I really believe that. Your mood will shift. Sometimes if you've supported classes, if you're on a sport team, some evenings you don't feel like going along, do you? Come on, admit it, you know. you know, oh no, I don't want to go tonight. I can't face another baked potato, whatever it is. But doesn't that shift during the evening? It does, doesn't it? It shifts during the evening, and the tiredness kind of disappears. Doing things together can be another great way of getting to know someone without having to do a lot of talking, if that is a difficulty for you. Arta City would be delighted if you offered to help out in some way, and Tara Dosa would, I'm sure. They have small teams of people here, sometimes doing decorating and that kind of thing. It's a really good way of getting to know people. Which moves me on to the third thing, beneficial activity. Not just doing good. Being a force of good in the world. Doing whatever helps people spiritually. Whatever helps them to attain higher and ever higher levels of being and consciousness. The Bodhisattva practices beneficial activity by sharing with people his own experience of the Dharma. Sharing with them himself. The Bodhisattva teaches people by encouraging them to grow and develop. Inspiration is the single most important factor in the whole of the spiritual life. So the Bodhisattva benefits people by inspiring them, by sparking them off, by communicating them to them the emotional positivity, the creativity, and the excitement, the sheer adventure of the spiritual life. I love that. The creativity, the excitement, the sheer adventure of the spiritual life. This enables us, fires us up even, to go beyond the comfort zone into the unknown, the undiscovered country, into the adventure of the Dharma life. And here again, giving is a form of communication. Because communication is about expressing ourselves through deeds and actions, and not just through words. You can say someone is important to you, but if it is to be more than just words, you need to express that. How much are you willing to put yourself out for your friend? How much are you willing to give up and give to your friend? And that is a question for us. Fourth one, the last one, exemplification. In other words, this is Bhante, the Bodhisattva's behavior is consistent with his teaching. His teaching is the Dharma, and his behavior exemplifies the teaching. He is the living embodiment of all the qualities that he encourages others to develop. He inspires people to lead the Dharma life because he's inspired. I think Bhante Sangharakshita is a great example of this. Here, he says, a difficulty arises, not so much for the Bodhisattva, but for us who are still trying to become Bodhisattvas. We have a vision of the ideal, but we can't live up to it. In fact, sometimes we fall very short of it indeed. We sincerely believe in it. We are inspired by it, but we find it difficult to transform our lives in accordance with it. But he says the discrepancy we feel between our vision and our ability to live up to it need not prevent us from trying to communicate it. All that we really can communicate is ourselves. And the key, he says, is to be as honest as possible. We can rejoice in our successes and, if necessary, confess our failures. We need not be afraid to be honest. We need not hold back because our practice is not good enough. What he's going to come across is that whatever point we are, whatever point we've reached so far, we are trying to make an effort to evolve. So last week, I talked at some length about moving out of our comfort zones. And I gave examples of this from my own experience. I said that moving out of the comfort zone can be seen as not just challenging, but as adventurous. I think there are times when we need to move out of our comfort zone with our spiritual friends. We might ask them for their impressions of us. Perhaps we keep getting into the same sort of difficulties with other people. From our point of view, there are always good reasons for this. It's always somebody else's fault. What can we do? Or circumstances beyond our control. So we might ask them, our friend or friends, for some reflection. Of course, what they say will have a subjective bias to some extent. But it is information. It could be useful information. They might say, they might be bold enough to say, well, you're not very good at listening. That's one of the problems. They might say that to you. And if they say that to you, that is quite flattering that they're able to say that to you. It's important information. It's worth thinking about, isn't it? Another important area of help that comes from Sangha is being able to talk about your doubts, your confusion, and your hopes and aspirations, even your inspirations. I remember having a discussion in a hotel bedroom in India with not just one, but three of my good friends. We didn't plan it. It wasn't a meeting. We were just hanging out. And we were just moved into a deeper sharing of our deepest longings. We were at Bodh Gaya. It was an order convention. There were sort of 500 or so order members at the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. And many of those order members were Indian order members, very poor backgrounds, who travelled from the other side of India to be here. And were so delighted that we had travelled to India to be with them. And it was really, really kind of humbling. For them, the Dharma represented a revolution in consciousness. It gave them a path to human dignity, a path towards helping others. So seeing more closely the Dharma revolution in India, the four of us in this hotel bedroom, we were kind of trying to understand how could we bring the Dharma revolution more to bear in our lives back in the UK. How could we do that? And we were talking about this and we were listening to one another and we were kind of adding to what each other's were saying. It was fantastic. It was a fantastic communication. We were friends in the good life. We were friends in the Dharma life. I loved these people. And coming back from that, that happened 2-3 years ago, we've all, not consciously, but we've all taken steps into a deeper responsibility within the Sangha. It's mysterious how that has happened. Yes, we drew each other out. And were drawn out. It was wonderful. That is one of the real wonders of Sangha to me. I had a deeper, from that meeting, I had a deeper sense of the possibilities of Sangha and how they were life-changing. I'm going to finish now with just a few points to throw at you. Can you take a few more? Yeah? So just reflect on the four Sangha building virtues. So we had generosity in the way that Bhante was talking about. Normally we're a bit worried in Buddhism, aren't we, about attachment. Don't get attached, people think. And the way Bhante is talking here, he's talking about connect more deeply in a way, get positively attached to other people. So generosity, giving gifts. Give of yourself and enjoy giving. Bhante said once that you don't give until it hurts. Salvation Army used to say that. Give until it hurts. He says you give until you swoon with ecstasy. I haven't encountered that yet, but enjoy giving. It connects you with others. Pass things on, share things. Friendly speech. Celebrate others. Don't miss an opportunity to appreciate others. Pass on the appreciation you've heard of others. If you like this talk, tell someone and they will tell me. If you don't like it, let's keep that as our little secret. Don't pass on slander ever. Yeah, don't do it. Just do not do it. Do whatever you can to help the Sangha. Get involved with projects. Initiate projects. We had a talk last Friday from John, who's one of the mitras here, who is heading wholesale at Windhorse. And he said to us at the end, or said to us during the talk, come and tell me if you've got any ideas. There is no such thing as a stupid idea. Yeah, just come and tell me, whatever. So I say that to you, there is no such idea as a stupid idea. Don't inhibit yourself. Hang out with people you meet at the centre. Hang out with your friends, mitras, order members. Hang out with them. Go on retreat with them. Take them to the cinema. And let's deepen community. Let's create something wonderful, more wonderful here in Cambridge. Let's build on what we've got here in Cambridge and take it further. There's so much potential, I think. Let's create something wonderful in our Sri Ratna Buddhist community. And let's really welcome the world into our centre.
Same Dharma, that's something we share, that we're talking the same language. So a lot of this is music to my ears. I don't know about you, I don't have a perfectly retentive memory to go away and remember everything that Arthur Priya said. But there is something about these talks that resonates for me, and I go away and reflect on it. And he's encouraged us to reflect particularly on the Sangha of Vastus. And I realise it's much easier to do that if I'm not thinking of it as a list, but if I remember the stories he's told us. He's evoked not just the ideas and the theory, but he's brought, well, the ethics of communication in that vivid evocation of the crucible. He's evoked Sangha building by Hataka and the story from the Pali Canon. And he's brought alive the Sangha Vastus in a way by adding anecdotes and encouraging and exhorting us through his own enthusiasm engagement to allow us to reflect how we might deepen our own practice. I could make a suggestion, and that is you encourage someone else to come with you next week, and then this Sangha will have doubled in size. So if you can think of others who should come and hear the evocation of the values of spiritual community, then please help with that. Next week, Sangha is altruism, so we've already touched a little bit on that this week, but I'm sure we'll have a vivid introduction to it next year. Manning the lifeboat, Sangha as altruism. Thank you very much.
So just in case there are any, not just questions, but are there any points you would like to say? Anything that struck you from what I said? We've got a few minutes if you want to do that. Next week we may, depends on circumstances, but we may have a bit longer to do that. But we're going to see next week. But anything, any questions, any issues, any thoughts?
I just want to say, I thought it was so great. I feel I've got this long list of things I could do in my head, which is probably a dangerous thing, but I feel very inspired. Inspired. So thank you.
Thank you. Have got anything to say?
I just really enjoyed hearing your just enthusiasm kind of pouring out about this area. I mean, I would prefer personally just to kind of go and have a cup of tea and chat, you know, just kind of hear what the sound is. I find this format so I don't particularly have something to say right now. I've got anything to add, but I'd be delighted to hear.
Talking about what's struck them. Also, if we're going to have tea. tea, there'd be a chance for people to give each other hugs. Which is appropriate way to end this.
I just finished by saying one thing, if I may. I'm going to talk quite a lot tonight, but this is the year, isn't it, of spiritual community. And Ratnagoshi asked me to give some talks about that. But I almost feel like things can get lost after a talk, can't they? So you can be moved. We need to do something. We need to channel any kind of enthusiasm that has been sparked off in something, in a project. I don't know what that might be, but much of what I was talking about, the ideas of Bhante's, you know, and how to take this further, how to kind of build on the various events we're doing as part of this year of Sangha. Maybe you could think about that. Maybe I could think about that. And it's almost like enthusiasm needs to become action, doesn't it? Become activated in the world in some way. Let's have let our first action, our next action, be drinking some tea. So thanks again for coming. See you next week.
Thank you.